Welcome back to Digital Village right here on KPFK Los Angeles 90.7
FM. 98.7
FM
in Santa Barbara. 93.7 in San Diego, 99.5 in Ridgecrest and China Lake, and streaming across the universe at kpfk.org. I'm Rick Allen.
My name is Doran Behrens. Hey, I forgot to mention, in about a little more than 20 minutes, we're going to have a live update from today's march in downtown L.A.
Southern California Climate Protest Day.
The People's Climate March. KPFK is going to be down there in Wilshire, Vermont at 1 o'clock. We'll hear more about that in about 23 minutes, but before that, we have Brittany Gallagher. We have telescopes. I'm so excited.
A far-reaching interviews by Brittany coming up.
I'm Brittany Gallagher, reporting to you on Digital Culture for Digital Village. This week is part two of our series on telescopes. Thankfully, Earth's atmosphere is not transparent at most wavelengths. Imagine what life would be like if our atmosphere did not filter out X and gamma rays. Of course, there are some wavelengths that we can use to view the cosmos from the surface of the Earth, like visible light, near-infrared, and radio. Today, we're looking at telescopes that will be observing in predominantly visible light. The first is the European Extremely Large Telescope, or EELT for short, which is a land-based optical and near-infrared telescope. The second one is for the hobbyists, a telescope where, after calibrating, is as simple as pointing your smartphone to the sky and clicking. We start with the EELT, which, upon completion, will be the largest optical telescope with a primary mirror at almost half the size of a football field. My guest is Joe Liska, an astronomer at the European Southern Observatory. What are the specifications of the EELT that make it unique?
Okay, so the main specification of the telescope is already almost in the name. So the main specification is the size of the primary mirror of the collecting area. So it has a primary mirror of just over 39 meters in diameter, and with that size, it will be the largest optical and infrared telescope in the world. So that's by far the most important thing for the science and for us astronomers, because the light collecting area determines how faint an object you can see. But the size of the primary mirror also determines the sharpness of the images that you can make with your telescope, i.e. the resolution of your images. How close can two objects be on the skies and for you to still be able to tell them apart and still be able to tell that there are two objects there rather than one object. So resolution and sensitivity, those are the two main parameters that we will gain in with this new telescope. Well, what we're doing for the first time in this telescope as well is that we're building into a telescope a technology called adaptive optics. So it's a technology that corrects for the turbulence in the atmosphere, and this turbulence in the atmosphere reduces the resolution of our images. So this adaptive optics we've been using for quite a while in astronomy, but this is the first time that we'll actually build it into the telescope. For this to work, what the telescope needs to do, it needs to look at a pretty bright star, and it needs to analyze the light coming from that star in real time while the observations are going on. So what's happening here is, like, if you stand in your backyard at night and you look at the stars, you can see the stars twinkle. Now, that twinkling has nothing to do with the stars. The stars themselves don't twinkle. That twinkling is caused by turbulence in the Earth's atmosphere. It makes the image of the star dance around ever so slightly, and that with the eye we perceive that as twinkling. But that dancing around, if you're taking a long integration image, that dancing around actually just smears out the image that you're taking. With adaptive optics, what you're doing is you look at a bright star and you analyze in real time how the star is dancing around, and from that motion of the star you can calculate what the distortions of your image are that are caused by the atmosphere, and you can command a flexible mirror somewhere in your optical path to distort itself in just the right shape to take out the distortions that are caused by the atmosphere. About 1,000 times per second, the telescope analyzes how a bright star is dancing around, analyzes what the atmosphere is doing, and commands a mirror in your optical path to deform itself to correct the image. So this technology then allows you to essentially untwinkle the stars. But for this technique to work, you do need a very bright star in the sky. But that's a problem because there aren't that many very bright stars out there. So what happens if you're trying to look at some distant galaxy that doesn't have a bright foreground star nearby? In that case, what you do is you create your own star, and you do that by shooting a laser out, and you're projecting a star into the upper atmosphere. The telescope can then lock onto that artificial star and analyze what the atmosphere is doing. So these lasers, we call them laser guide stars, and essentially they're artificially projected stars in the upper atmosphere.
What new technology has been necessary to build this telescope?
Well, actually, not too many new technologies are necessary. We went to some lengths to try and ensure that we do not need to do any research and development to build this telescope. Or, you know, most of the subsystems in this telescope are things that industry knows how to build today. That was done on purpose, simply to cut down on development times and to cut down on the risk that something might go wrong during the construction of the telescope. But there are a few areas where the engineers are looking at, including the control of the telescope. So another future activity will be the development of hopefully some new coatings that will make sure that we get the highest efficiency out of the telescope.
The telescope gets the information, so it's taking images, right? It's not taking video.
Well, yes, in principle it takes images, but if you think about it, taking a video isn't really that different from taking images. It's just taking lots of images and taking them very quickly. And in fact, some of the instruments of the telescope will also be able to do that. They will be able to take images very, very quickly. So there are some science applications where you want to be able to do that. But you're right. Normally, you would call it images, but images is not the only thing. The telescope will also produce lots of spectra, so where you take the light and you break it up as a function of wavelength. So spectra and images, those are essentially the basic types of data that we get from the telescope.
How is the data going to be analyzed? You're going to need to use supercomputers?
No, not really. You certainly don't need supercomputers. You'll be able to do this on more or less standard desktop computers, as we do for the most part today. So it's not like in radio astronomy. So our colleagues in radio astronomy that are planning to build a square kilometer array to be able to use that data, they will need a supercomputer. But for us, that won't be the case. The data rate from the telescope is actually going to be pretty marginal. It won't be easy. It's not like that you'll get the data from the telescope and you'll be able to write your science article from that data within a day. So, you know, these are still complex data sets, but not the volume per se that is a problem, or the computing power that will be a problem.
What questions are you hoping to answer with the EELT?
So the EELT is not being built to answer a single scientific question. The science case, the motivation to build this telescope reaches really across the entire science of astronomy, going from the solar system all the way out to cosmology and understanding the history of the cosmos and fundamental physics. Having said that, there are, of course, a few things that we are particularly keen on, and one of those things is certainly studying so-called extrasolar planets. So these are planets that lie outside of our own solar system. But what we want to do with the EOT is we want to start studying these, at least some of these planets, with enough detail to be able to say, at least in the long term, whether there may exist life on their surface. The idea here is to find Earth-like planets. And for these planets, we would like to try and look at their atmospheres and determine the composition of their atmospheres. And the idea here is that on Earth, we know that the emergence of life completely changed the composition of the Earth's atmosphere. So the fact that the Earth is oxygen-rich today is a consequence of photosynthesis, really. And so the idea is that if you look at an atmosphere of an extrasolar planet and you find the right elements and molecules, so things like water, things like oxygen, things like ozone and methane and CO2, if you find them in the right combination, in the right amounts, then that would hopefully give you a strong indication on whether life exists on the surface of that planet. So the idea is that you would look at these planets, determine these compositions, and then see if we can exclude all non-biological origins of this combination of these elements and molecules. And then what you would be left with, essentially, would be the idea that, yes, indeed, this combination must be caused by some biological source. And I actually believe that this is our best shot at finding extraterrestrial life.
How far away can you tell?
Not very far. I spoke earlier, I said, you know, what you want is an Earth-like planet that isn't is at the right distance from its parent star. So that right distance from its parent star, that's what we call that the habitable zone. It turns out that the habitable zone, in general, is quite close to its parent star. If you follow along with the thought experiment, if you imagine a big floodlight in a football stadium, and then you take a tiny little LED, and you just take this LED and you place it just a few inches, about 4 inches, next to the big floodlight. And then you move away 200 kilometers. And then you look back and you try to see that tiny little LED in the glare of the floodlight from a distance of 200 kilometers. So that's kind of like trying to see an Earth-like planet around the sun from a distance of about 30 light years. So essentially the answer to the question is, you know, we won't be able to study them out to very large distances. We will only be able to do this in our immediate vicinity out to something like 20 to 30 light years.
We are searching for life outside our solar system with the EELT. What other things do you hope to uncover?
Yeah, for example, we want to team up with the James Webb Space Telescope and look out into the very distant universe and try to find and then study the very first generation of galaxies. With the telescopes that we have now, we have not seen that first generation of galaxies yet. Detecting these galaxies, these first galaxies, is a key science goal for the James Webb Space Telescope and the EELT. Another thing we can do is, because you have that increased resolution, is you can look at individual stars in other galaxies, so not inside our own Milky Way. The idea is that if you look at the properties of these stars, you can actually determine the ages of individual stars, and thereby you can reconstruct the formation history of the entire galaxy, and you can do this bit by bit for different parts of the galaxy. So with the EELT, we will be able to do that for the first time. So that is another important science goal for the EELT.
I've been speaking with Joe Liska, an astronomer at the European Southern Observatory, about the European Extremely Large Telescope. Construction has already started on the EELT, and they hope to start analyzing images in 2025. It will be located in the Atacama Desert in Chile, which is one of the best places in the world for optical ground-based astronomy. Interesting fact, they had to take down 18 meters off the top of the mountain so they can make the surface large enough to fit the telescope. Now, we've talked a lot about telescopes that scientists get to play with, but what about all of us hobbyists who also love to look up at the cosmos? My next guest is Brian Cogdell of Celestron to talk to us about their $400 Cosmos 90GT Wi-Fi telescope that you can control with your tablet or smartphone. I saw this 90GT Wi-Fi telescope at CES earlier this year, and it blew me away. Can you describe the telescope?
That's a really exciting telescope for us. It is a huge leap forward. So you've got a telescope that is computer controlled that will point to objects for you. But now you can control this telescope with your own device, your own smartphone or your tablet, with the app that we provide for free. And it does so many things that kind of takes it a step forward above other telescopes before that did automatic computerized pointing. Normally, you have to enter some kind of information. Usually, you have to put in date, time, and location, or you have to buy a GPS unit to do that for you. Usually, you have to identify a couple different stars in the sky, and just doing that is already that intimidation factor. It takes some time. With the Cosmos 90GT Wi-Fi, is actually controlled via Wi-Fi with your existing smartphone or tablet. And it's the first telescope to do this. It's the Wi-Fi is built in to the telescope. And removes a lot of the steps that you previously had to do to get a telescope to align itself with the night sky. So using the free app that we provide for iOS or Android, the name of the app is Celestron Cosmos Navigator, and it is inspired by the Cosmos television series, Cosmos Space-Time Odyssey. So we have Celestron Cosmos Navigator, the free app that will control the Cosmos 90GT Wi-Fi. All you have to do is align the telescope on any three bright stars you see in the sky. You don't have to know what they're called. As long as you see three bright stars in the sky, just align on those. The telescope will then synchronize itself with the night sky. Now all you have to do is just tap on any of the pretty objects you see on the graphical display of your tablet or your phone, have the telescope move right to that object for you. It's a really simple. And the nice thing is, too, because you have that app, you've got this interactive display. It's very dynamic. It's not just a star chart. You could fast forward in time or reverse in time. Let's say Jupiter tonight. I can't see Jupiter right now. I'm in the office, but I want to know if I can see the red spot tonight. Well, I could go to the object Jupiter in the app, fast forward to, say, 8 p.m. tonight. Is the red spot out? Or I could just look at it throughout the night, fast forwarding it, and say, oh, the red spot's going to be out at, say, 9 o'clock, and take a look. And the app really helps you plan that. It's a really nice tool. Before you even get to use the telescope, you can kind of plan what you want to do. You can read all the information about it. There's even like an audio narration tour. I look at the Andromeda Galaxy. Okay, I'm looking at the eyepiece. What am I looking at? There's a lot of information there, including a little audio clip that'll explain to you what are you looking at, you know, so you can kind of appreciate what you're seeing as you're looking through the telescope with the help of the app. Those are all things that you didn't have before, that multimedia and interactive experience that really, I think, kind of ties it together to not only make the thing easier to use, but you get more enriched content out of it. So I should say that by itself, the app is really cool. And then you unlock its full potential when you use it to control the telescope.
What will I be able to see with it?
So the 90GT in the name, so that 90 is referring to the diameter in millimeters of that objective lens. So a 90 millimeter is big enough to see great features within our solar system. So definitely, not only see Jupiter, you'll see the cloud belts on Jupiter, you'll see its four Galilean satellites, you'll see the rings of Saturn, you'll see incredible detail on the moon, and that's something that really, I think, is sometimes underrated. You really should see the moon with something like a 90 millimeter. It's just awesome. You can dive into the craters and valleys and mountains, all sorts of details.
Wow, have you gone out to Joshua Tree with it or something where it's a bit darker?
Oh, yeah. Anytime, if you go to a dark sky, then you, with any telescope, and the 90 included, you could see fainter and further. So those kinds of skies, we go to a dark sky, the deep sky objects really stand out with much greater contrast. The good news is, let's say you are viewing from the city, and a lot of us, and I do too a lot, if you're viewing the moon or Jupiter or Saturn, solar system objects, they're very bright, high contrast objects that really aren't affected by light pollution. The deep sky objects, however, they are affected by that. So if you want to see a great view of some galaxy and you want to see some cool little spirals, you're better off then going to the darkest sky that you can. But a lot of, there's just so many things up there, like I could still, for example, the Orion Nebula is a bright one. I could see that from a light-polluted area. But you make a very good point. When given the opportunity, take something like the 90GT is very portable. Throw it in the trunk of your car, take it to a dark sky on a new moon weekend, and you'll see the full potential of the telescope. That's where, you know, portability is very important. As a common saying of like amateur astronomers, the best telescope's the one you use the most often. And you want something that you can take with you, especially if you know you're going to go to a dark sky. Something like this, I could pick the whole setup in one go.
Now that we have Wi-Fi powered telescopes, what's next?
Yeah, certainly. Now you can see this being that big step forward. We're going to be trying to push more of our telescopes and go to technology in this direction. But it's really this seamless integration of having computerized pointing, being able to control it with your phone or tablet, making it easier to use, having things align automatically. All these things we actually have right now, and you're going to see now us push towards integrating this more and more and making it seamless so that you have one really awesome telescope system that's easy to use that does many of the things that used to be a chore. It'll do those things now automatically for you.
Yeah, and it really does bring backyard astronomy and just astronomy in general, I think, to the population, because a lot of it was, especially, you know, when I was younger, it was hard. It was a big learning curve, but now I feel like the learning curve is going away pretty quickly. And I'm not to say that it's not fun to go map it all out and figure it out. And a lot of people will still enjoy that. But I think for the average person who thinks space is awesome but might not want to go through all of that time and effort to learn how to use an older telescope will be very much excited by something like this.
Speaking to what you said, this being easier and just being able to let hold the iPhone up to the sky and look at what you're looking at, that kind of shortcut, or people say that's cheating, that actually does enable you to learn as well as it is easier to use. So So if I don't know a thing about where anything is in the night sky, this does everything I need. But if I have that increased interest and want to know where some of these things are, it's a great tool for doing that, because I can kind of map out what I'm looking at using the app with the help of the telescope. And it's just really the best of both worlds. So it's a shortcut, but it still enables you to really get that full astronomy experience.
I've been speaking with Brian Cogdell of Celestron about their Cosmos 90GT Wi-Fi powered telescope that is controlled by your tablet or smartphone. The future of telescopes is an exciting one. From tennis court sized space telescopes like Webb that will see back 13.5 billion years into the past, to the Square Kilometer Array that hopes to figure out what dark energy is, to the EELT that will help us answer one of humanity's greatest questions, are we alone? The next 10 years are going to be integral in expanding our understanding of the universe. I'd like to close with some fine words from the late, great Carl Sagan.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are a way for the cosmos to know itself.
No one could put it better. That's it for this week's edition of Digital Culture. You can find out more on our website at www.digitalculture.la or follow me on Twitter at @NAQuantumWorld.
Century, doing something mean to it, do it better than anybody you ever seen do it. Screams from the haters, got a nice ring to it. I guess every superhero need his theme music. No one man should have all that power. The clock's ticking, I just count the hours. Stop tripping, I'm tripping off the power.
Yes.
Star stuff.
I'm schizo. I downloaded it. I downloaded the Celestron Cosmos Navigator.
Now you just need that telescope.
And now I just have to align my Cosmos 90GT Wi-Fi with my telescope. Wait a minute. I have to buy a telescope too?
These kids today, with all their high-tech stuff.
I thought these apps were free.
When I was your age, I had to focus my telescope
by
hand.
That's right. Darn you.
Yeah, well, hey, it was worth the wait, though, to get Brittany's report.
Yeah, that was great.
And, yeah, again, if you want to find out more about what she's doing, at digitalculture.la is their specific website.
Hey, yeah, you can go to our digitalvillage.org website and click on their link.
That's right. All right. Now, we have a special report.
A special guest.
A super special guest and a super special report. Today is the People's Climate March, both in New York City and
L.A.
Not surprisingly, right here in Los Angeles. And not surprisingly, KPFK is a proud
sponsor
of the event, which is occurring today. And on the phone, we are joined by KPFK's interim program director, I believe that's his title, Alan Minsky. Hi, Alan.
Hey, Doran. How you doing? Hey, Rick. Honored to be on Digital Village, of course. Thank you for the great show, as always. And in fact, a very special thing today. We are not only the media sponsor of today's event, we are actually participating in the event, which is something that, you know, as a 501c3 nonprofit broadcast media organization, we can do around issues. And KPFK has taken the step today to not just be the media sponsor of the demonstration in Los Angeles taking place on Wilshire Boulevard. We are also participating in the event. So you can find KPFK in the demonstration today, which begins at 1 p.m., and I'll describe how this rather unique demonstration works. We are at Wilshire in Vermont at 1 p.m., and so if you go down to the demonstration on Wilshire Boulevard today, which starts at 1 p.m., look for the KPFK contingent at Wilshire and Vermont.
There's a conveniently Metro Red Line stop right there, so if you don't want to take the Metro, you can get there and get off at Wilshire in Vermont.
Yes, and it's a huge set of events that are taking place in New York. The big march is actually tomorrow in New York, and KPFK will be broadcasting live. The demonstration in New York, our broadcast is hosted by Amy Goodman from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. tomorrow. Richard Wolff's economic update will be preempted for 1 week for this historic event in New York, which they are anticipating will be the largest climate change demonstrations in the history of the United States and maybe the history of the world. And the UN Climate Summit begins on Tuesday in New York City. Of course, there'll be an incredible focus from around the world on the UN Climate Summit, and there are a lot of planned actions in New York City, beginning with the big march tomorrow. Today in Los Angeles, it is called Building Blocks for Building Blocks of Protest Against Climate Change, and it stretches all the way down Wilshire Boulevard, which will not be closed. And the way that today's demonstration works is organizations and even individual groups have signed up for a corner on Wilshire Boulevard from Alvarado, which is the east side of MacArthur Park, mm-hmm. all the way to Wilton. And there are big organizations like the Sierra Club, the California Nurses Association, the 350.org, Bill McKibben's great climate change organization, all the way through to individuals who have groups of people. And the decision of the organizers was, instead of, you know, marching through downtown L.A., where a lot of times you have a sense like you're going through empty streets in downtown on a weekend day, they're going to keep Wilshire Boulevard open, and it's going to be block after block after block after block, people up on the corners, including KPFK.
Yeah, again,
and Vermont.
So, again, all the way from Wilshire and Alvarado, which is at MacArthur Park, all the way down into Wilshire and Wilton.
Right through the center of Koreatown. It's a large demonstration, and it should be very excited. And you know, since I'm on, you know, digital culture, mm-hmm. digital village with Rick and Dorn, you know, obviously one of the most important issues facing humanity is climate change. And we're so far into the digital age, you know, digital culture, the development of digital strategies are going to be central to the fight of humanity against climate change and all the forces, institutional, economic, political, that are propelling us into this crisis ever deeper and deeper into it. So, you know, I hope people out there, big fans of the show, come on out, bring their thinking caps on, talk to people about strategies to utilize every technology we have at our disposal as humanity to combat this crisis.
That's the only way it's going to be solved, is by us talking to each other and working through this. I was telling Rick before the show that I have seen and read, well, I've seen nothing in television broadcasts, heard nothing on radio broadcasts outside of KPFK, and seen very little in print about this event today. So with the social media in particular, becomes very important for something like this, so that we can keep in touch, so that we can communicate, so that we can let each other know what's going on and where, because the so-called mainstream media isn't going to help you in this.
Oh yeah, and by the way, again, the list of the way they have this organized on the website for the event, which is againstclimatechange.org, againstclimatechange.org. That is actually the site specifically for the Los Angeles event. The list of participants is unbelievably huge. It's alphabetized, so it's you know, so many organizations: United Teachers of Los Angeles, Claremont College, Loyola Marymount University, and there are just tons of them. So there are going to be a lot of people out there, and it should be a big demonstration, and again, as you said, we have to bring all that we have as humanity to try to conquer this crisis, which is growing ever deeper.
Okay.
And I do think people are really stepping up in terms of trying to think through what it will take. Naomi Klein has a new book out. She'll be on KPFK in the next few days, and then she'll be participating in the events in New York. And again, utilizing all the technology we have at our disposal, there's no doubt that the coordination of tackling a crisis like this is going to take these marvelous machines that are, of course, featured on digital Village every week.
So people start heading for Wilshire, what's our KPFK corner again, Alan?
Wilshire in Vermont, right in the center of it, and we'll be there representing KPFK. Come on up, talk to us. I'll be there starting at 1 p.m. Margaret Prescott, I know, will be there. A number of KPFK people will be there. So stop by Wilshire in Vermont. It is Los Angeles's participation in this week of climate change demonstration in advance of the UN Climate Summit that begins on Tuesday. And remember, tune into KPFK at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning to hear Democracy Now's coverage live from the huge climate march in New York City.
All right. Thank you, Alan.
Thank you. Alan Minsky, Interim Program Director here at KPFK. And that is it for this week's edition of Digital Village. If you want to write us, my email address is doran@pacifist.net. D-O-R-A-N at pacifist.net.
And Doran will pacifist everything onto me, the good, the bad, and the climatically
challenging.
Yes. Thank you. And you can hear this show again, because it was a lot of good stuff, by going to the audio archives at kpfk.org. Where you can follow links to our own website at digitalvillage.org.
And you'll find there our own audio archives, as well as links to our blog, podcast, and our Twitter feed, where you can follow us at DV Radio.
And you can also follow us at Facebook. Please like us on Facebook. Just go to Digital Village Radio. You can sneak a KPFK in there, too, while you're searching.
All right. Thanks to Jeff and Master Control. Stay tuned next for Politics or Pedagogy, followed by the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. Until next week, my name is Doran Behrens.
My name is Rick Allen, and we'll see you online.